My name is Phil Bennion. Thanks to Timmy for inviting me here for this event. I'm a former member of the European Parliament for the Renew Group. I'm from the Lib Dems in the UK, and I'm actually a working farmer with a PhD in agricultural science. So that's my sort of credo for being invited to moderate this panel. I'm just going to start off with a few comments of my own on agriculture, because I've been involved in quite a bit of research, a few research projects on decarbonising agriculture. I've also witnessed at first hand the attempts of politicians to grandstand on radical ways of decarbonising farming, and I think that has some impact on what is going on now with the farmer protests we're seeing. In fact, my friend Sean Kearney wanted to know whether I was in Brussels last week for the protests. I have taken part in farmer protests myself over the years, and I think I have some sort of insight into what's going on. I know that a lot of people have been blaming the far right in sort of inciting farmers to get discontented, but I think it's the other way around. I think what's happening is the farmers are very, very discontented, and the far right are trying to bandwagon and take some credit for it. And I know a lot of farmers, and that very, very, they just are not of the far right mentality. So what's driving it? I mean, I think a lot of it is the sort of incongruent or irrational approach to decarbonising farming that we sometimes see. There's quite a lot of good ideas out there, and farmers are really taking that up. They're trying to do less cultivation, and yes, we can. Sequestration is a possibility. We can get a little bit of carbon into the soil, but politicians very often think that's an ongoing process. Oh, you can put on 1% of organic matter in your soil in 5 years. Maybe in 20 years you can put on 5%. It doesn't work like that. What we have is a new equilibrium. So you reach the new equilibrium and you stay there. So we're being told to try and do things which are impossible. We have other areas. We've got this. This is a well-known target of reducing pesticides by 50%. Well, the real fact is that pesticides actually preserve yield. So by reducing pesticide inputs, unless it's done extremely judiciously, what we do is actually push up the carbon footprint of every ton of grain, every litre of milk. You push up the carbon footprint. I think the farmers are getting really frustrated, because these measures actually increase their cost of production, for which in a world market there is no price increase for them, and it has got to a head. I'm producing wheat now at £170 a tonne. That's the price going out off the farm, and my group of farmers who are benchmarking reckon that is the cost, that is the actual cost of production when you discount back office depreciation and drawings. So we are actually cash negative on what we're selling at the moment, and when you're cash negative and you're pressed by politicians with unworkable solutions, then you get discontent. But there are some bright areas, and I was discussing with the commissioner last night, green hydrogen, green ammonia, and there was something I read from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization 3 or 4 years ago that said the only way of decarbonizing, really, if you're serious about decarbonizing agriculture, is decarbonizing nitrogen fertilizer production. And they were suggesting that green ammonia should be targeted at producing nitrogen fertilizer, because 50% of the emissions from agriculture are from fertilizer, but the fertilizer actually produces It is responsible producer for producing 50% of the world's food. So it's very, very easy to decarbonize agriculture by just stopping doing it. But the result, of course, is mass starvation. So it's an extremely difficult problem. I'm going to say a little bit about industry, only a little bit, because I don't know very much about it. But not only do we have protests from farmers now, we have, certainly in the UK, where I'm from, we have protests in South Wales with Port Talbot, with Tata Steel, deciding to close the plant. But they are intending to rebuild it as an electric arc furnace or several electric arc furnaces, which are far more not just energy efficient and moving towards carbon neutral, but very much more flexible in terms of how they work. Currently, it is a coal-fired blast furnace. But, of course, the people who work there who are being laid off are very sceptical that the new plant will ever be built. So we have challenges there too. So I'm going to now turn to my panel, having said my piece. We've got a great panel for you. We've got Charlie McConnellogh, the Minister of Agriculture, Food and Marine here in Ireland. Niamh Gallagher, she's Director of Public Policy for Amazon Web Services. Matthias Olafsson from Iceland, head of the Methanol Institute, so we might be able to look at some alternative fuel possibilities here. And Kieran Conlon, who is from Data Centre Government Affairs, Microsoft, Ireland and Western Europe. So, because I think we have got to look at lots of different small incremental approaches to decarbonising agriculture, and also heavy industry is a particular issue which needs its own special approach. So I'm going to ask them all in order. So I think we'll probably start with we'll start with Charlie and then move this way. It's easier, I think, if we do it that way. Just in 2 or 3 minutes, what are the challenges that you see in both sectors? And hopefully give us a few pointers towards a successful outcome in terms of decarbonisation. So 2 or 3 minutes each on, and you can stick to your own sectors or you can be a little bit broader if you wish. And if you want to say a little bit more about yourselves, just a fuller introduction, then I'm quite happy with that. So, Charlie, over to you.
Thanks very much, Phil, and good to see so many here today. And thanks to Timmy for organising this conference. We're very proud to have him as co-leader of ALDE. And it's wonderful to see this really important conference here based in Clare today, and also so many really prominent guest speakers coming, and indeed particularly to see the Commissioner here, but particularly all of you who are so important here in Ireland as stakeholders, but right across Europe too. Obviously, you've outlined it there, Phil, in relation to, you know, there is a challenge in agriculture and in relation to how we can decarbonize, but there's real potential there, and there's really exciting work happening too. And agriculture as well has a really important role to play as well in relation to how we can contribute to decarbonizing industry, particularly through the potential that's there for the production of biomethane. And in terms of our national climate strategy here domestically, we've set a target for 2030 that 10% of our total national gas requirements here in Ireland will be produced on farm through biomethane. And we're shortly be launching a biomethane strategy in relation to how we take that forward and develop the industry, because we certainly are not as far forward in Ireland here as many of our European friends are and colleagues are, and we have a bit of catching up to do. And it's something we're very committed as a government to work with the industry to make progress on. Looking then particularly at agriculture, we have about two-thirds of our emissions here in Ireland. We're pretty unique in European terms. Yes. Because about 10% of overall European emissions are agriculture-based and food-based. In Ireland here, it's almost 40%, yeah, because we're quite a productive food-producing nation, and also we don't have the same industrial base that some of our some other European countries would have. But two-thirds of our emissions are methane-related, and one-third then from agriculture is related to fertilizer production, for example, small-butt carbine. Yeah. a small bit of carbon. But if you look at what's happening in relation to the nitrous oxide part, which is, makes up most of the other third, there's massive work happening at farm level. Significant reduction, not just related to price, but because of behavioural change over the last 2 years. 2 years ago, we had a drop in fertiliser use in Ireland of 14%. And that was added to last year by an additional 17%. And that's because farmers have been very proactive in relation to how we see changes and innovation happening at farm level. Soil sampling, for example, use of multi-species sward, taking the nitrogen out of the air through using the right plants and putting it into the soil as opposed to having to use chemical fertilizer. And it's exciting what's actually happening there. And you mentioned the challenges, you know, across Europe at the moment, and that... There's real issues there, but we don't put enough focus on what's actually happening at farm level right now, the exciting work that's ongoing, and also the massive potential that's there in the years ahead to really deliver as well.
Yeah, thanks. Kieran.
Good morning, everyone. This is my second time in Glore. I was just telling colleagues before we came on stage, the last time I was here, my son, who went to school down here, my two kids went to school in Scariff and Ennis, so I'm very familiar with Ennis. I was sitting somewhere over here, and he was in a Christmas musical wearing a Father Christmas hat. I sent him the picture last night and told him, Jack, it's time for Papa to take over. And, so, look, it is great to be here. As I was driving down in that nuclear winter last night, quite late, I was thinking about what I was going to talk about, and obviously I'll talk a little bit about Microsoft and our ambitions in this space with our data centers and renewable energy and sustainability commitments. But I was thinking about Claire and how Claire is at the center of this conference, but it's not the first time Claire has been at the center of this agenda. Next year will mark the centenary of the commencement of the Ardna Crusha hydroelectric power plant on the Shannon. For the non-Irish people here or those unfamiliar, it was the largest civil engineering project in Europe at the time, and it was a partnership between the Irish government and Siemens. And it took 9 years to build. The budget at the time was a whopping 5.2 million, which doesn't sound like an awful lot now. It was 20% of the then government's total revenue. And that government was only four years into the foundation of the Irish Free State as an independent country. The hydroelectric power plant generated 87 megawatts of power. Again, not a trifling amount, but it was enough to meet the full electricity demand of the state at the time. And that project, I think, just when we think about Ireland's green our national industrial policy for offshore wind, which will have probably a significant factor to play around Shannon when it comes in off the Atlantic. Clare and renewables and sustainability have always been part of the Irish and hopefully the European conversation. So that's that sort of ambition is something that I really love to see in what the Irish government are looking to do and hopefully bringing in 37 gigawatts of power off the West Coast by 2030. I have some concerns about how that might happen and whether it will happen. I'm not sure if the type of mindset that built Ardna Crusha 4 years into a new independent state's existence can translate to that type of ambition. But that's the type of ambition I think that we all need to sort of display both as industry and as government. My background, by the way, outside of Microsoft, I spent 15 years working in politics. I was an advisor to the former Fine Gael, Taoiseach Enda Kenny, and then for 5 years in government between 11 and 16, I was advisor to the Minister for Environment, Richard Bruton. So I've got a sense of how things can sometimes get clogged up and how things maybe can move forward. But if we broaden it out to the European context, and I'm getting to the data center issue, at a European level, at a policy level, we have Europe's digital decade on the one hand, and then we also have the Fit for 55 agenda on the other hand. Now, they're both very obvious policy ambitions for society, and it responds to public interest and government ambition. But if you look closely at those agendas, there's a risk that they become conflicting. If you're looking to digitize and you're looking for more and more data, then you're looking at more and more data storage and processing.
Yeah.
And then how do you then also tally that with the Fit for 55 agenda? Of course, I probably would say that, and maybe Niamh would say the same or something similar, but data centers are I describe them as the superheroes that make that thing happen. Because if you decide that they're policy ambitions as a society that we want to achieve, then the next question is, how do you best do that? And what is the infrastructure? And as a fledgling state in 1925 decided, one of the things that we need to achieve our social and enterprise ambitions is major infrastructure. Data centers, to me, are 21st century infrastructure to enable the type of modern, connected, always-on, inclusive society that we all tend to have ambitions for. Microsoft wants to be part of that journey. Microsoft, in its energy ambitions, we have an ambition to be fully renewables by 2025 for all our data centers. We're very close to that already. I think that will happen. We've seen the energy efficiency of data centers just increase at an exponential rate, so that we've seen from 2010 to now that the share of the energy consumption of data centers has stayed at about 1 to 1.5% of the total energy used globally, yet the processing and the data requirements have increased by a factor of something like 12. So as one grid has gone like that in terms of society's use of data and requirement for data, the energy graph has stayed flat. That's a testament to how the technology evolves, but certainly as an industry, we know that if this is going to work, we have to work in collaboration. 100 years ago, it was the Irish government and Siemens. Today, it'll be Europe and many other companies, hopefully trying to find the best way to get the solution that will deliver those twin ambitions. So, thank you.
Yes, Dave.
certainly, and Kieran, I think you captured really well that we can't decarbonise without digitalisation. Mm-hmm. And the Commissioner said it this morning, I think the message is clear and it's coming from Europe, it's coming from our national government. But the strength of the cloud, and I mean, the reality of the cloud is that it's made up of data centre infrastructure, that is mm-hmm. what it is what will enable this digitisation. And we heard the Commissioner saying, she can sit here and she can adjust her heat pump in Estonia via her phone, because that data is hosted in a data centre, ideally one run by AWS or Microsoft for this panel, but and hopefully operating very efficiently. But I think that's critical. But I think, Phil, when you set out your question, it was around what are the kind of challenges to achieve decarbonisation, right, for agriculture and industry. And I think from an industry point of view, the need to modernise and expand the grid and the need to increase and accelerate the adoption of renewables are just critical. For us as AWS, for us as the data centre industry, and I assume for many other industries across the board, because we need the grid that can enable business growth, that we can get renewables onto quickly, we can get clean power, and that can enable that digital future that we talked about. At COP28 this year, there were 130 countries agreed to triple renewable energy adoption by 2030, and there were 25 businesses, including Amazon, that encouraged those countries to take that ambition. So when you think about that scale, tripling from where we are today, it's actually enormous. But to get there, we need to really increase the adoption of wind and solar in Europe. Amazon is the largest corporate purchaser of clean energy, of renewable projects in the world and in Europe, and I think we can play a really key role in driving that forward. But one of the things that delays us in that kind of acceleration and delays everybody are permitting challenges. Mm-hmm. So I think there's this combination of improve and expand the grid, enable faster, more efficient permitting so that those projects can come on stream much more quickly. And then you achieve, I suppose, that kind of renewable generation, which is key, which leads to the digitization, which is critical to decarbonisation. So there's a whole kind of set of interconnected things, I think, that industry needs to happen to achieve the decarbonisation goals, which are policy driven.
Yes.
And I think it's great to have the audience with the Commissioner and to see the alignment and even that she's using those technologies herself day to day.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the grid and the requirements, because 20 years ago, my good friend and colleague Graham Watson, who used to when he was an MEP, he used to lead the ALDE group in the European Parliament. He was telling us all then that we had to develop a supergrid, because if we were going to move to renewables, we need to even out the problems with different weather conditions, and we needed to be fielding renewable energy from a very, very large area. And to do that, we needed massive infrastructure, massive investment in the grid. Going from North Africa, where there's a massive possibilities for solar as well as wind, right through to Scandinavia. So, and he was, that's a project he's still flying the flag for. And yeah. I think I just want to say a little bit more about that, rather than just leaving it that we need some investment in the grid.
No, and hopefully we talk about it more. I mean, certainly, I hope over the course of the panel we will get that opportunity.
That's right. And of course, it gets a lot of public opposition because these big pylons are going to go across, so we don't want them here. It is a difficulty bringing the public along with us on these projects. Anyway, Matthias.
Yeah. Yeah, first, let me thank the organizers for allowing me the opportunity to visit West Ireland for the first time, and the opportunity to visit this beautiful town of Ennis. As Chief Europe Representative of the Methanol Institute, I represent about 100 entities across the methanol value chain. Those are the world's biggest producers of methanol, also technology suppliers, and now consumers of methanol, especially in the shipping segment. And I should probably clarify that methanol is both a chemical and a fuel that can be produced from wastes. And I think what I wanted to contribute to this panel today on agriculture and industry is the idea to look at waste from agriculture or industry, whether it's carbon that is currently emitted into the atmosphere or biomass agricultural waste. To look at that as resources to power the decarbonization of mobility, specifically. I think what we need to do is to look at that waste that comes from these industries and see an opportunity to strategically map their capacity to address our goals when it comes to the decarbonization of mobility, our collective goals in Europe, of course. And I was asked to elaborate on the challenges posed to this undertaking, and I think in the interest of time, I'll just limit it to one, which is the complexity of the regulatory framework that we've created in the European Union on being able to deliver these fuels to market and to leverage these resources that are found in waste from industry and from agriculture. And I think, what the European Commission has done these past few years is to make very clear demand signals for these kind of fuels and these kind of energy carriers. But at the same time, they've also made it almost impossible to produce them. They've created a scenario where the eligibility criteria for what constitutes sustainable feedstocks has become so limited that it's incredibly difficult to attain bankability for these kind of projects. And I think, what I got the opportunity to speak to the Minister of Marine, among other things, backstage earlier, and I delivered what I considered a very inspirational speech about the opportunities for Ireland to kind of position itself in the context of the energy transition and leverage its geographical location to produce fuels that can be used to propel ships in a sustainable way, ships that go across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And I think in order to do that, we need to collectively look at, for the next few years, to revisit delegated acts pertaining to greenhouse gas methodologies for what they call renewable fuels of non-biological origin in the European Union, which is a buzzword for fuels made from electricity, and for the Renewable Energy Directive's criteria for adding feedstocks to what is constitutes sustainable feedstocks for fuel production. And I think I'll leave it at that in the interest of time.
Yes, I think the biofuels or renewable fuels, they've been in for a bad press just recently, and a lot of the NGOs have been super critical of them, and And I think to the extent that they were seen probably 15 years ago as the answer, but now they are subject to vilification almost by the NGOs. And I think it's gone too far in the other direction. Because as you've pointed out, shipping, how are we going to get ships around the world? There's also in my home sector again, agricultural tractors. So these alternative fuels are going to have to be used for certain for certain tasks. Electric tractors are just only for vineyards and orchards. Because you cannot put a 200, 300 horsepower tractor in a field powered by batteries. It would be so heavy it would sink, and it would only run for 2 hours before it needed recharging. And where is it going to be charged? You can't charge it in the field. You know, this is it's just not practical. But alternative fuels, it's the answer. Whether it's synthetic hydrocarbons or methane or methanol or that, there's almost any, even hydrogen, there's almost any form of these fuels will work. So I think this is an area where we've got to look at. We've got to be less judgmental in terms of particular technologies, because some of them that we've sort of cast aside have a place. And I think alternative fuels definitely have a place in the future of decarbonisation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm going back to Charlie. You know, you talked about nitrous oxide, for instance. You know, management of nitrous oxide, it can be, you know, it can be managed to reduce emissions. You've also talked about schemes to get more nitrogen into the soil through legumes and such like. What particular sort of schemes are you looking at in Ireland? How are you managing those sort of schemes to bring the nitrous oxide emissions down? Because obviously a lot of nitrous oxide emissions are weather dependent, and particularly in a climate like Ireland and West Britain, it's a challenge.
Yeah, well, we've been doing a lot in terms of the different schemes we put in place to promote the type of change that's needed. So, for example, in relation to measuring soil fertility, and at government level, and I would have introduced a scheme over the last 2 years, which is paying farmers to measure their soil and to sample their soil to get an accurate read of it, and to make sure then as well that we're keeping it at the right pH level, which means that what you're actually putting on the soil gets the maximum impact. So you're putting less on and you're getting more out of it. Also then as well, you know, a scheme, for example, I ran on a one-off basis last year was to pay farmers to lime soil again, to put lime soil to get the pH.
So you're actually subsidizing them to.
It's an incentive.
Giving them incentive to lime soil. That's interesting.
And just to get people back, get people into that behaviour, which is going to make a real impact.
Yes.
Because it is profitable on its own right. It stands up, but it's about driving on that behavioural change as quickly as you can. And then the other step I took, the other scheme I put in place in the last couple of years as well was paying farmers to actually put multi-species swards into their soil again, because likewise that's pulling naturally through the legume, through the plant, the nitrogen out of the air into the soil naturally. And that is seeing now the big results. We're seeing a significant drop in fertilizer use. The other thing we've pioneered then at national level has been a more efficient use of organic fertilizer, of slurry manure.
Yeah.
And we've significantly invested through grant aid in grant aid for low emission slurry spreading machines.
The injecting.
And that has led to significant change. That also has contributed then to a reduction in chemical fertilizer. So in terms of the one-third in agriculture that is nitrous oxide-based of our emissions, there's real potential there. We're also then, though, I mean, research is key to all of this and investment in that. So in relation to the methane side of it, and we're putting significant funding into that as well in relation to, for example, verifying the potential for feed additives to reduce the methane output from the same size of herd that we have currently, and that can make a real impact too.
That's good. It seems that you take a far more intelligent approach to it than the British government has been over the last couple of years. Although some of the things you're doing are similar to what we've been doing within the industry in Britain, certainly trying to look at ways of improving the soil. Keeping it lined, keeping it at 6.5 to 7 pH, and and building a little bit of organic matter so that it acts as a buffer, so that the nitrogen is held better, and you can get that. You can probably reduce 20-30% nitrogen inputs through soil management. But this management issues are really important. So I'm glad we're all moving in the same direction here. But it is incremental. It's not. There's no silver bullet here. It's incremental.
And the other point, which is really important, is that a lot of these steps we're taking are actually improved profitability as well.
Yes, exactly.
And improve the margin.
Yeah.
Because you're more efficient. You're reducing the your inputs, and you're also using what you're putting on more efficiently. And we've set a target, for example, under a climate action plan for agriculture to reduce its emissions by 25% out to 2030. Now, that's part of an overall economy-wide objective of reducing our emissions, national emissions, by 51%. But really importantly, as part of the measures that are going to help us achieve that 25% reduction, 60% of that can be delivered in a way that also improves profitability.
Yes.
So, you know, it's about creating behavior change, it's about knowledge transfer, and by taking that approach and investing in that, we can improve profitability at the same time. Obviously, the other measures then we're looking at, we're going to have to look to see how we can work with farmers to support the cost of that.
Yeah, and of course, research is, particularly with the Irish situation, we're having a large livestock sector, ruminants, work on feed rations that have been bringing down methane emissions from cattle and sheep. I think this is also very, very important, and more, probably even more important in Ireland than it is in any other European country because of the reliance on ruminant grazing.
Good to see you again.
Grazing.
That's my inner voice.
So, Kieran, ambitious targets for your industry. What strategies for heavy industry do you think? I'm sort of dropping you in the spot here, but what do you think that heavy industry? How can heavy industry move towards carbon neutrality over the next 10 years? And if IT and technology's got a role, then please.
I'll be slightly challenging and say I'm not sure about heavy industry, but I can speak about data centres.
Yes.
There was an issue in Dublin recently about an attempt to rezone data centres from a certain category that's a standard enterprise category into a heavy industry, so in terms of zoning and whatever else, data centers are a very clean industry and whatever. I'll come to that in just one second. There's just one thing I've meant to pick up on, and we talk about cloud services, and it's just one of my sort of bugbears. It's probably one of the worst titling exercises ever undertaken by a sector, I think, given that what people are actually talking about, massive physical infrastructure. If you talk about infrastructure as a railway or a port or an airport or a hospital, people see it, they feel it, they touch it. But you talk about digital infrastructure, you use it all the time, 100 times a day, but you never really see the infrastructure that underpins it. So that's just something that I've always had a bugbear. In terms of the data center industry, again, I think governments are, I would say, fortunate. I know from my time in government, you're always looking to find partners outside the system to broaden the bandwidth of the government toolkit, if you like. It's always a challenge when you're in government that you have a certain number of levers that you can pull, but you don't have all the levers. And the way that you extend your reach and impact and capacity is good partners. I like to think that an industry and companies like Microsoft, AWS, we get it. We understand our role in being a partner for a long-term collaboration to deliver this type of infrastructure. The spirit of Ardna Crush, it's there 100 years later, and it's still delivering onto the grid, you know? So corporate purchase power agreements, that's a big thing that the data center industry drives. AWS will do a lot of this. Other companies will do the same. Microsoft in 22 signed the largest PPPA set of deals in Europe. over 900 megawatts of renewable energy that helps decarbonize the grid, helps create the market, mm-hmm. and goes towards that matching 100% figure, and with capacity available, you know, when not needed on the data centers. But the technology is moving so quickly. You know, so battery storage is going to be an important thing. So we've been trialling a battery storage facility in one of our data centers in Dublin. So that means that you manage the flow, and you can, with the renewables, because it's intermittent and it's not reliable, you need to have some capacity to manage the phases of the availability of the grid. If battery storage could become more mainstreamed, and I think that's probably a direction. Like in an Irish context, Baringa have a report that says if you had battery storage, managing that management of the grid that fossil fuels has to do to make sure that there's always capacity available, you could reduce about 20% of our emissions from fossil fuels. So it's technology like that. There's hydrogen fuel cells as well for a similar sort of solution. In an Irish context, it's a difficult topic, and I wasn't even sure if I'd allude to it, but nuclear, like in other jurisdictions.
No, I think it needs to be referred to.
So like in Ireland, it's in our constitution for the non-Irish people that we cannot have nuclear in the country. That's how committed we were in the 1980s to the idea. But we're going to have a Celtic interconnector to France in maybe 3 or 4 years, and we'll take nuclear-generated electricity from France, and we're already doing it from the UK as well. That's a great Irish solution. but I think that's going to be part of the longer-term conversation as well. But again, my bigger ticket idea is this idea of that spirit of Ardna Crusha. Can we take on big challenges collectively? I know the political context, and we're having a bit of a conversation backstage with the minister, and the political context is so challenging to do big things, to get big projects in the interest of society done, because the sort of atomization of our opinions, our views, and getting consensus is so challenging. So I think the minister in his portfolio is actually one of the most progressive ministers we've had in that role, and he's to be applauded for that. But I know the challenge is to actually get those big things moving. And you spoke about the institutional thing. Massive issue.
Moving on from that, Eve, I mean, you can see that the web services, the data industry is actually part of the solution in terms of enabling the other technologies to take place.
Maybe just to build on some of what Kieran said as well around what do we need to do to decarbonise industry, and you know, heavy industry, if you want to talk about the data centre industry specifically, but sort of tech broadly, I think at a really high level we need ambitious targets, right? And we've got them coming from government, we've got them coming from EU, but in fact as companies we set them ourselves. So in 2019, Amazon co-founded the Climate Pledge, committing to be net zero by 2040, 10 years ahead of Paris. We also made a commitment to be fully powered by renewables by 2030, which we'll deliver by 2025. So you've got your targets at a high level. Then you think, okay, how do we deliver them? And to my mind, there's two ways. One is through how we power our infrastructure. And that's back to the core point of renewables. So I mentioned with the big purchaser of corporate purchaser of renewables, Microsoft, another huge purchaser of PPAs, etc. This industry is driving the renewables industry through the targets that we've set for ourselves, right? So I think we need to be able to do more of that. Our global portfolio now is 28 gigawatts around the world. We've got 160 projects in Europe. We want to do more. So that's going to drive change. But then alongside that, we need to make sure that our infrastructure is as efficient as it can be. And actually, that's the piece I really like. You know, everyone has a kind of different parts of their job that really excite them. When I see some of the things that we're doing within our data centres, from chips to cooling to everything in between, it's extraordinary. And, you know, it's also in our interests. We want to run our data centres as efficiently as we can because it means we can deliver better prices for our customers who are using those to serve their customers, right? That's the business model. So just take Ireland, for example. we have done our first district heating scheme in Tala, where the waste heat from our data centre in Tala in South County Dublin, through a partnership with the local city council, heats local homes, 47,000 square metres, so three times the size of Croke Park, huge stadium here in Ireland, of public sector buildings and commercial buildings. It's a really good example of no waste, absolute efficiency and contribution to the community. Chips. We are constantly developing new chips to be more efficient. They go into our servers, they go into our racks. The latest Graviton that was launched this year runs at 60% more efficiency than a comparable chip. Again, in our interest, we're doing the same with ML
chips. Is that in the sense of the efficiency in using less energy? You mean?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Because then we can do more within each individual data centre. We talked about fuels, HVO. We have moved to using hydrogenated vegetable oil in our backup generators across our data centres. We started with Ireland and Sweden. We're rolling that out across all of our infrastructure. So those kinds of measures which are contributing to decarbonisation, which are helping us to run more efficiently, contribute overall. And the final one I should mention, in fact, is circular economy. And I think this is getting much more airtime. And again, policy from Europe is helping to drive this, policy from Ireland. But we waste very little of what goes into our data centres. So we reuse, we recycle precious metals, servers, materials. Yes. You know, that kind of thing doesn't get lots of publicity, but our biggest reverse logistics hub, so where we undertake our circular economy activities, is in Dublin. It's an innovation hub for the whole of Europe, Middle East, and Africa. That work is happening everywhere, and you know, it's something I think we'd like to talk about more as an industry. And you know, we're only starting to, but so I think the combo, you've got to have the targets, you've got to have the renewable delivery, and then you've got to be absolutely efficient in how you run your infrastructure.
Yeah, and of course, this sort of sophisticated data networks are needed to manage things like grids, manage industry in terms of managing the new technology to actually deliver the decarbonisation solutions within each sector.
Exactly. I haven't even got that far to the customer end, but of course, yeah.
And finally, over to Matthias. Right, you've talked about the maritime sector. Can you say a little bit more, because you were quite short on the first time. I think there's quite a lot of potential here for decarbonisation in the maritime sector, and it is pretty dirty at the moment.
It is, and you know, right now the global maritime sector emits around 300 million tons of carbon dioxide, and both the European Union and the International Maritime Organization are implementing protocol regulations to drive the decarbonization of this segment. We've now seen that there are already 220 vessels that will be running on methanol in the next few years, large container vessels with a large fuel consumption. And then in 2030, those will be 1,200 vessels using fuel in the order of around 40 million tons. So I think, you know, when you look at an area like Ireland where you have the potential to produce moving forward if you look at a time frame in the next 5 to 6 years, you have proximity to the downstream segment, the high value downstream segment, and you have feedstock availability for production of valuable fuels, I think here's an opportunity for some political vision on implementing projects which will deliver significant value creation for Ireland.
Yeah. And I've been told we're just about out of time, so I'm just going to ask you all just for one key proposal to move things forward in about 30 seconds each.
Yeah, well, I think there's many things in agriculture, but the one thing which is going to cross over into heavy industry as well and transport is that piece in terms of how agriculture can contribute here domestically in relation to biomethane generation and anaerobic digestion. Yeah. And that's a big priority for me and for the government over the next period of time, and it's something that can deliver more internationally as well, but it's a big space that we will be focusing on here domestically.
And you were sort of market leaders at one point, because I came over here on a course about 10 or 15 years ago, and it was all about what farmers were doing to produce things like biomethane, and we were coming from the UK to learn from you. So I think you're up for regaining that position.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah.
Kieran.
Yeah, great. It's one idea. It's an idea. I think it's to get for institutions and governments to realize that we're at a tipping point in terms of a new industrial revolution. I won't go through all the wording and whatever else. But that requires a complete overhaul, I think, of the institutions that are responsible for delivering on this next wave of modernization of this next phase of society. The grid needs it, the investment and all the rest of it, but I think unless the human capital side is invested in significantly to change how we can deliver those things, the physical capital will always lag. And that's I think, where I would start.
Yeah, Eve.
I would say modernized, expanded grid, which can enable all the other things we've talked about, which is accelerated renewables, decarbonization, electrification.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and I would say adapting a long-term times sort of horizon for energy transition projects for heavy industry and agriculture, connect them to mobility, and to not jeopardize good for perfect by enabling simplified regulatory frameworks which can deliver decarbonization progress in a timely manner.
Yeah, thank you. As a final point, I'd like to see politicians work more closely with industry, so that rather than grandstanding on impossible technologies that don't work, that they can actually work with industry, bringing industry with them, and I'm talking about agriculture as well, to develop solutions together and then get them implemented quickly. Because once you know what works, and when a lot of us do know what works, then we can actually get on with it, because there's no time like now. We're already late in the game. So I'd like to...
Siemens, 100 years ago.
Yes. So I'd like to thank the panel, and I hope you can thank them in the usual way. Thanks.
Thank you very much.